You should see the places they play in the Soviet Union.
Oh, I'm planning on it.
You have to get past me first.
I'm planning on that too.
Hello, I'm Ben Bailey-Smith.
And I'm Sasha Bates.
And thank you for joining us on Shrink the Box. This is where we place TV's most talked about characters on the therapist's couch. We psychoanalyze the likes of Fleabag, George from Seinfeld, Shiv from Succession, and more. Sasha here is a psychotherapist and I'm an actor, and we are your trusty guides to why your most loved characters create so much chaos in their wake. At the beginning, we heard a clip from what, Sasha?
That was Beth Harmon from The Queen's Gambit, which was the most watched show on Netflix in the USA in 2020. And it won 11 Emmys and 2 Golden Globes.
Oh, man, that's a lot of shiny trinkets. It was off my radar for a long time, probably for the same reason as a lot of other guys where, you know, you've seen the sort of runny, punchy, kicky, you know, Breaking Bad
stuff.
Action and all of that. And then you hear there's a show about chess and you're like, nah. And I sat down, got into it, and I was immediately hooked. The design, the production design is phenomenal. I would enjoy watching it even if the story or the characters weren't A-grade fascinating. Fortunately, they are.
I think what I'm so intrigued by with Beth is that there's two versions of her, and we see them both. It's almost like an overture in the first few minutes of the first episode.
Right, okay, because it's more young Beth we're seeing, right?
Yeah, well, actually, even before we get to young Beth, there's the, I think the whole thing opens with her in the bath, and she's hungover.
Oh, yeah.
She's having the guy from the hotel is banging on the door, waking her up, and she's clearly been on a bender all night. She's chaotic. She's wet. She's semi-naked. And then very quickly, we see the other version of her, which is completely together and immaculate, not hair out of place, and she's controlled. And we discover that this chaotic woman is also this incredibly controlled chess master. So we see those two polarities, and it's a bit like with Walter last week, where with Walter we saw the sort of very white and black of his character. Mm. We also see binaries in Beth, which I love the symbolism of the black and white chess pieces.
Of course. And if you haven't watched it for a while, I highly recommend you pull it out. But here's a quick overview. We're in 1950s Kentucky, Lexington to be precise. And as we were saying, we meet the young Beth Harmon, who's 8 years old. She's just lost her mother in a car crash and is taken to this orphanage where she's taught chess by the building's janitor, Mr. Schabel, who's played by Bill Camp. And the orphanage gives out these mysterious kind of green capsules, which are some form of tranquilizers. At the same time, as her addiction grows, her skills with the chessboard also grow. She's clearly a prodigy with this stuff. So that sort of gives you an idea of where we're at, and a little reminder in case it's been a long time since you've seen it. I should also say, as we talk more about The Queen's Gambit, there's going to be spoilers. I mean, you're going to get that every week on Shrink the Box. It's kind of the vibe. There's also probably going to be some bad language. You know, chess can be very stressful, can put a lot of pressure on us all, Beth included. So look out for any naughties. Welcome to Shrink the Box. So here we are again, 2 p.m., Sasha Bates' office. Tell us a bit about today's client. It's Beth Elizabeth Harmon.
We pick her up at the age of 8 when her mother dies in a car crash, and we follow her until her early 20s. And that takes us through her arrival at the orphanage. She becomes friends with Jolene, who is an older black girl who kind of shows her the way of the world. And then at 15, she's adopted by Alma and Alston Whatley. Alston leaves them very early on, so she and Alma again have to sort of negotiate the world together. And she then picks up an alcohol habit as well as the drug habit that is continuing.
Let's have a listen to Beth. Let's hear her. Here she's talking to a Life magazine journalist. You'll hear a photographer snapping away in the background. Check this out.
They're just pieces. And anyway, it was the board I noticed first.
The board?
Yes. It's an entire world of just 64 squares. I feel safe in it. I can control it. I can dominate it. And it's predictable. So if I get hurt, I only have myself to blame.
And there's definitely something in finding safety in this place that other people may not understand at all. I had this exact experience just last night. I was hosting the British Independent Film Awards. And then, you know, there's, you know, a lot of glitterati there, you know, there's very famous people. And people kept coming up to me before when I was sort of preparing, going, "Oh, are you really nervous? I've just seen so and so in the crowd. I've just so and so's here." And like, number one, I don't want to hear it because that is going to make me nervous. But number two, it's like, I don't operate in the same way as you. Like, when I'm up on the stage, that's where I feel completely at ease and in a safe place. And it's just like Beth said, it's the control thing. When I'm up there, I set the tone, I make the rules. Everybody shuts up and they only talk to me if I ask them to talk to me. In actual life, where I can't control anything to do with other human beings, the impossible shyness kicks in, the feeling that I've said something wrong, the anxiety rises. I don't think there's any coincidence. And people wouldn't believe that because they think somebody who makes a living in this way must be equally loquacious, equally confident in all walks of life. But it just doesn't work that way. So I really hear that. And Beth, of course, if you are unaware, is played by Anya Taylor-Joy. And that clip was from episode 3 of The Queen's Gambit, which is called Doubled Pawns, which you can stream now on Netflix. I highly recommend it. It's written and directed by Scott Frank and also written by Alan Scott and based upon the novel by Walter Tevis. We'll give you the full credits for all of the clips at the end of this podcast, as ever. What's the very first issue we discover with Beth?
The effect of trauma and loss. And she really has the most extraordinarily traumatic early life and how that feeds into her becoming these two versions of herself, the controlled chess genius and the chaotic addict. I mean, you've got loss, which is awful. Then you've got traumatic loss, where the loss is completely unexpected, which brings in a whole other layer of terrors. And then you have the effects of how that loss was handled. And even before you get to that, you've got how solid somebody's sense of self is, even before they've had the loss or the trauma. So on all four of those measures, Beth is hit hard. She didn't have a stable sense of self before her mother's car crash. We know that because through the flashbacks, we can see that her mum had her own mental health issues.
Yes,
they lived in poverty.
Erratic.
Her dad had abandoned her. Her mother gives her, you know, very clear messages of self-reliance. Then she had the traumatic loss, which is awful for anybody. But if you have a more solid sense of self, you have a greater chance of being able to heal from it. But you then also need somebody to help you heal from it. And she doesn't. She gets put into an orphanage.
And do you think she retains a fear of people abandoning her?
Yeah, absolutely. But this will probably be out of awareness. She won't be, her brain isn't mature enough to really understand that. So this will be the subconscious and the physiological response kicking in to save her from too much information, because that information is too terrifying. I think when she went to the orphanage, nobody actually asked her what it was like to lose her mum. Nobody gave her any space for any feelings. And we get the impression that she didn't have any space for any feelings beforehand either. So she has to shut that bit down. She has to kind of freeze it out. And that's a common trauma response, to just disown any of the feelings that you don't know how to manage. And at 8 years old, she can't manage them. So she's had to literally exclude them from her awareness. So she has to find another way to feel that she's connecting, because she can't connect with people because they leave her. Her mum, her dad left her originally. She hasn't really got any warmth or affection within the orphanage. So she has to find her own way of controlling.
As orphanages go in the 50s, generally it's actually not bad, but she, Beth, doesn't seem to engage with it. Like a sort of weird, creepy, inverted Annie or something. She just has zero emotion about... Mm-hmm. Why do you think that is? Is that another sort of protective...
It's completely protective, yeah. And often the people that look like they are doing the best job are the ones that are most frightened underneath. I mean, it's not dissimilar to you saying, people see me on stage and think I'm doing this completely without any fear. But actually, there's a lot of fear going on underneath. And a lot of people that represent as very calm and collected who have suffered trauma, when you take their cortisol levels, you realize that actually they're really stressed, and internally their hormonal levels are revealing what their external appearance can't reveal. There's a psychotherapeutic theory called attachment theory, which I think is really relevant with Beth's case, where if you're securely attached to your caregiver, then you have a reliable prediction that if you get upset, they will soothe you. If you have a caregiver that is maybe anxious or depressed or just abusive or neglectful or volatile, you can't build up that reliability that if I'm upset, they will soothe me. So you have to turn away from them. And it's called avoidant attachment. So there's different styles of attachment, but Beth seems to be very clearly showing avoidant attachment, which she thinks, if I get upset, not only will I not be soothed, but I may actually be blamed for that. So I'm just going to become self-sufficient. I'm going to rely on myself because I don't believe that nothing in this world has shown me that adults or another person are going to be the thing that soothes my upset. So she turns to Chess. But you mentioned Jolene, her friend, the old black girl.
That is not fair. She got here after you. Most of us are lifers. Been here a long time.
And don't forget your headband.
Nobody's going to come for us now. We're too old.
And don't dawdle.
Not too black.
Jolene as well is an orphan. She hasn't been reliably mothered either. So yes, they do meet and have some sort of mutual connection, but these are two avoidant people meeting. So it's still not a really adequate substitute for a really warm, caring relationship. And same with Mr. Scheibel in the basement. He also is very avoidant. He gives her nothing in terms of warmth. He gives her chess lessons and he gives her a safe place to go, but it's not in a kind of, oh, come here, my poor dear, tell me how you're feeling kind of a way. Yeah. That avoidant attachment style, which she manifests quite clearly, is actually showing us that underneath, she's probably so stressed, so upset, but she's got nowhere to take that. So she's had to freeze it down. She's had to like freeze all those emotions, dissociate them, shut the door on them.
These templates that we have, are they fixed or can they be changed with work? Can they be healed, so to speak?
They can be, but it takes quite a lot of time and a lot of work. You can get what's called earned security, earned attachment. So Beth, early on in her life and through most of her, even when she's adopted, she has an adopted mother who actually, interestingly, I think is also quite avoidant. Again, she's not this sort of warm, gushing, empathic, compassionate mum. She's somebody who has her own issues with alcohol, who is quite distant. And they find a way to communicate and find attachment within each other. But it is very slow process, this building of trust. So you see it in, they'll occasionally take each other's hands when one of them's upset. So they can only show it in a very distant way. But I think people can definitely find secure attachment figures later in life. Often it is a therapist, or it might be a teacher or a grandparent. You might find a partner who kind of, in a way, enables you to trust enough that those frozen parts of you that you've had to dissociate, they can start to thaw, and then you can start to become attached. And I think that's a really clear path with Beth. For me, I like the symbolism of when she arrives at the orphanage, she is like a pawn that people are going to move around. She doesn't like it. Yes. So she thinks, I'm going to become royalty. I'm going to be the queen so that I have control over, I can master my own life. But then she experiences everyone else in her life as pawns. They're not real people. She doesn't see them as having their own interior world. So she uses them. But gradually towards the end, she realizes that maybe they're not just there to be used. Maybe Jolene and Mr. Scheibel weren't only there as sort of stages on her journey. They were actually real people. And she sees at the end that both of them held her in mind. Jolene says, oh, I was watching your progress from afar. She finds the notice board in Mr. Scheibel's basement where he's kept all the clippings of her success. And that's another way you can kind of earn security and earn attachment, is by understanding that just people aren't out of sight, out of mind, that they've held her in mind, that they've kept thinking about her, even though she had moved on from them.
You are thought about. That's a very sort of warming feeling. And you know, what you often hear from depressives is that, you know, what's the point? No one cares. You know, it's hard for me to even care about myself. You know, I'm unlovable. It's never always true. You know, so much of that can just be a story that you've created in your head.
Everything that we do, they're all defenses to stop ourselves having to feel really hard emotions if we don't think there's anyone there to help us navigate those emotions.
I was reading about the origins of chess. It was like an ancient Indian political war game, basically. It's a strategic game of war. And it developed over time, and the Europeans sort of added the twist of royalty into it, the concept of the leader being royal. The designs changed with that about, I don't know, 250 years ago. But it's been around for a long, long time. But from the very beginning, it was about outwitting your enemy, playing the long game to ensure that your enemy was defeated, not necessarily with sudden violence, but with, you know, smarts, cunning and patience. Fascinating that it's chess that she's picked. Similarly, like I say with me, it's when I really, really like worship my privacy and constantly worry and panic and feel anxious about what I've said or did in front of people in my private life. Why on earth would I choose a profession that thrusts me and my character into the public sort of domain and even beyond that?
It seems like you allow a version of yourself that isn't shy and doesn't have anxiety and doesn't worry about what people think of you. You allow yourself to have a version of you that is surmounts all of that. And we often do that. We'll find a persona that is very different. There's another psychotherapeutic approach called internal family systems, which says that it kind of sees the different roles we play in terms of being an exile, a manager, or a firefighter. So the exile is the bit of us that we really don't like, that we don't want to go near. So for you, that might be the shy, insecure, anxious part of you. Or for Beth, it is the bit that's like, oh, my mum isn't there for me. The orphanage people weren't really there for me. Even Alma isn't there for her. She dies on her in the end. So she's building up this picture of people aren't reliable. So she creates this, what internal family systems theory would say is she's created a protector self, a manager self, who's like, okay, let's button this stuff down. If we work really hard, if we become the best that we can at chess, if we don't let an emotion in, then we can manage the situation. However, what happens is that we can only ever manage a situation up to a point, and we see her fall apart. We see things start to happen, like she loses a chess game, Alma dies, she starts to feel less in control, her adopted dad tries to take the house away from her. So all these things are starting to loosen the ability of the manager to keep on top of it. So then what happens is another protector self, which internal family systems calls the firefighter, comes in to use a different way of protecting her. They say, okay, we're just going to douse the flames. We can feel the emotions coming. We can feel you losing control. So we're going to fling everything at it. And that's when the drugs and the alcohol come in. So it's another way of protecting. So I would imagine that the bit of you that gets you up on stage is a way of showing the more anxious part that, yeah, no, we can do it. This bit is also
I literally have that conversation with myself sometimes, you know, I feel the nerves kicking in and the shakes and stuff. And then I go, no, you know what you're doing. Mm-hmm. You know, there's a reason you've been asked to do this. There's a reason you've been hired. Mm-hmm. And I have to have those conversations with myself. There's another layer. We also have to acknowledge she's entered this world in the 1950s where she is a woman in 100%. It's a man's world.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, even if she was totally together, it would be tough. It would be a huge challenge. So she's got that to deal with too.
Have you ever played in a tournament before?
No.
Are you sure you want to do this?
I'm sure.
We don't have a women's section. I'll put you in beginners.
I'm not a beginner.
Doesn't matter. If you're an unrated player, you go in beginners with the people under 1600.
What's the prize for beginners?
20.
What about the other section?
First prize in the open is 100.
Is it against any rule for me to be in the open?
Not exactly.
Put me in the open.
There are three guys in there with ratings over 1800. And Beltic may show up. They will eat you alive.
we can never divorce any of us from our context. And she is a woman in the 1950s. And that brings a whole range of issues. And so for Beth, the character, it's never foregrounded. It's not the thing that she is fighting to combat. It's not the thing that she worries about. It's not her motivator, which I think if this was something written by a woman, I think possibly that would come into it a lot more. But Beth, the character, as we are presented to her in this show, and I presume in the novel, which I haven't read, it doesn't really figure large. So it's hard to really know what Beth feels about that, because that doesn't seem to be part of the journey.
Interesting. You get the feeling that, even though it's not like it's like some ancient show, of course, but you do get the feeling that if The Queen's Gambit was made now, there'd be a female-heavy input from a writing and directing point of view, and that would be right at the forefront. It's interesting. Now, many people, including the filmmakers themselves, say The Queen's Gambit is not about chess. But then what is it really about? The cost of genius, addiction, both? I'm thinking let's seal our next move in an envelope, adjourn, and we'll be back after a few relaxing games of speed chess. And we are back. Sash, the more chess games Beth Harmon wins, the friendlier she becomes with drugs and booze. And, you know, as I said before the break, the filmmakers don't believe the show is about chess and it's more about addiction and the battles with addiction. But I thought it was interesting, you know, watching her with her new mum, so to speak, Alma, who has limited boundaries, I would say, and almost encourages Beth to drink alongside her. And there's just a lot of boozing going on. And she takes to it like the proverbial fish to water.
She does. And, you know, in a way, how is she ever going to be different when the only role models she ever has are people who also try and quench their feelings with substances? So in the orphanage, it was imposed upon her with the tranquilizers because it made life easier for the adults to presumably control a whole range of kids if they were all a bit out of it. And then Alma, who is another woman in the 50s, of course, trying to manage herself in a man's world. Again, that's not really foregrounded, but she doesn't have many options available to her either. So she is squashing her own feelings down with alcohol. And so for her, that's completely normal. So she probably thinks that she's doing a nice thing by offering Beth sips of her martini and sort of teaching her that, yeah, this is quite a useful way to function in the world. Because we can only really teach what we've learned unless we deliberately go out and think, actually, I want to do it differently, which Tony Soprano was a little way. He kind of thought, I don't want my kids to have the life I had. But but Alma doesn't seem to be able to offer Beth anything other than what she knows. So the alcohol addiction kind of joins the drugs addiction.
Yeah.
And poor old Beth is slightly helpless for a long time to kick this.
What are ACEs?
ACEs is something that is beginning to be looked at quite a lot in adult presentations. And it stands for adverse childhood experiences.
Right.
So the more ACEs you have, and that can be loss, neglect, abuse, trauma, there's a whole range of things that get categorized as an adverse childhood experience. And so you can now correlate the number of ACEs that a child has had with the number of presentations that they have as an adult. And Beth has had a lot of adverse childhood experiences. And what can often happen is that if you have a lot of adverse childhood experiences or ACEs early on, many people do what Beth did and they shut them down and they try and get them out of awareness and they're frozen in time. But then later as an adult, something else will happen that will trigger them. And then they have a lot of responses like depression, anxiety, addiction that have been kind of kept on ice, literally. And as they start to thaw, all these new things come to light.
Fascinating to watch in a character, I have to say. Now, we've got a huge spoiler alert here. Please do feel free to fast forward a few minutes of this podcast if you need to. So go for it right about now. Sounds like Beth and Benny are having a game of speed chess again. Stop it, you two! Thank you. So Beth's biological mother, I feel like I'm whispering because it just feels so wrong, she crashes the car with Beth in it. The death was essentially a suicide. Now, if Beth were in therapy, do you think this is something that she'd reveal to you, Sash, in the process?
Over the course of the series, we learn that she deliberately crashed the car, which the implication being that not only was she trying to kill herself, but she was also trying to kill Beth. Now, that is a huge revelation. That is a huge thing for somebody to be able to get their head around. Beth, as we've seen, has deliberately frozen out all that knowledge because it's too painful to confront. And in therapy, people often don't know why they're coming. So if she were to come to therapy, she might come and say, well, I have an addiction problem or I have no close relationships. So that might be her presenting issue. So what happens a lot in therapy is that people come in thinking, I'm going to say this thing, and then they can't. And then as they're leaving, they're literally halfway out the door. And we call it the doorknob moment because they've got their hand on the doorknob that they'll suddenly fling in. Oh, by the way, my mum deliberately crashed the car. Yeah. She deliberately kills herself. And by implication, she was trying to kill me too. I mean, that is huge.
Beth living with this, subconsciously or consciously, those same tools and avoidant tactics, they help with that as well, right? Just not facing the most painful truth.
Everything she does is defensive to keep her from this knowledge. I mean, again, like Tony Soprano, but in a very different way. Her mum wanted to kill her and wanted to kill herself. So, of course, you're going to build barriers. Of course, you're going to defend yourself. Of course, you're not going to go near those memories unless you have to.
I suppose there'd be a fear of feeling like completely worthless.
Yeah.
How would someone like Beth, a lifelong addict, how would she move forward?
The thing that we can see with Beth towards the end of the series is that she is allowing more people in. She has got attachment figures. She allows the friends from the chess world to help her. When she's in the final match with the Russian in Moscow, they ring her up and the whole team of them, all these boys from the chess world that she's slightly discarded and used along the way, they're all there together helping her plot and strategize what she's going to do. So she's developing a support network that isn't reliant on booze or drugs. And that's going to be the thing that helps her through.
What can we all take from that? As I'm thinking, just listening to you speak, I'm thinking the importance of connection over isolation from human beings has got to be quite high up there, even just in terms of just getting by in life. Life is challenging for every single human being. Sometimes when I'm feeling low, I sort of rewind and think, well, the last 2 weeks I haven't really spoken to anyone.
Yeah, I mean, we evolved to need other people. Mm. If you're on the outskirts of the tribe, that's where you're going to be picked off by predators. So in evolutionary terms, the deeper within the middle of a tribe that you are, the least vulnerable you are. I mean, we all watch the David Attenborough stuff. We're actually not so different. In evolutionary terms, our nervous systems haven't actually moved on that far. So we are going to feel worse the further away from people we are. We all need people, and relationships basically are what are going to save you. But for some people, relationship can be very, very hard to come by for all the reasons we've been talking about. For Beth, relationship meant loss. It meant vulnerability. So she pushed it away. And that's also the ironic thing, is we push away the thing that we most need. We defend against the fear that's going to come with, if I engage with people, if I show them my vulnerabilities. And in doing that, we get even deeper into the loneliness that is going to make us feel worse. The thing that's going to save us is the thing we're pushing away.
Yeah, that's really, really deep. That was free, guys. That was free. Take that home.
I think for a lot of people, it can be really hard to accept love. And in a way, that's what I think is interesting about the relationship with Alma, because there's a point where she calls Alma and she says, oh, I'm hanging out with some friends. And Alma says, oh, were you stoned?
Oh, this is a stoner's house.
Yeah. And Alma says, oh, well, just be careful what you smoke, honey.
That's right.
And you could look at that as being sort of slightly irresponsible parenting. But for someone like Beth, it's really hard for her to accept love. If she had been adopted by some sort of warm, gushing mum who was trying to sort of cuddle her all the time, Beth
she
would
might have been
not,
a runaway or
yeah,
something.
She would not have been able to cope. She can only cope with the amount of intrusion that Alma gives her, which is very little. And that's a bit like therapy. You have to match the energy of your clients. You have to match where they are in terms of what they can receive.
Why does she tidy up that stoner's house? Why does she do that?
Beth doesn't like chaos. She needs the
it's
world
a control
to be.
Thing.
Yeah, it's like the chessboard, as she says. It's a square box. She knows where the edges are. She's got 64 squares to work with. She knows how all the pieces move. And suddenly she's confronted with a house where there's stuff all over the place. Nothing's tidied up. Not hair out of place on Beth either. You know, she's immaculate always. It's all part of the wanting to be in control. Mm. So she would feel very discombobulated by being surrounded by mess, but it's also the start of her seeing that maybe there is another way. Maybe she doesn't need to be so tightly buttoned up. I mean, that's the night when she loses her virginity.
Yeah,
where she,
good point.
She tries on, she finds a t-shirt and jeans in amongst the mess as she's tidying. She tries them on, and in a way, it is indicative of her trying on a different way of being.
Yes.
Can I loosen the reins? Can I be a bit less controlled?
I think we've mastered the Sicilian defense. I think we've improved our middle game. Play pretty well against the Russians. Listen, if you'd like us to analyse why your favourite characters made such risky moves, do email us at shrinkthebox@somethingelse.com. That's shrinkthebox@somethingwithoutthegelse.com. And please do follow us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, Amazon, you know, wherever you get your podcasts, and get the new episodes and share them with your friends. Leave us a little review. Let us know what you think about the show. And if you want to listen to Shrink the Box ad-free, then subscribe to Extra Takes, plus ad-free episodes and access to weekly subscriber exclusive extra episodes from our good friends over at Kermode and Mayo's Take. So start your free trial now by clicking Try Free at the top of the Shrink the Box show page on Apple Podcasts, or by visiting extratakes.com. Big thanks to our production team. Production management is Lily Hambly. The assistant producer is Bashak Erton. Social media is Jonathan Imieri. The studio and mix engineer is Gulliver Tickle. The senior producer is Selena Ream, and executive producer is Simon Poole. Sasha, who's going to be hitting the couch next week?
Well, next week, we're not only going to shrink the box, but we're going to think outside of it for next week's guest. This person is part of a hugely successful ensemble drama.
Okay.
And I think he's one of the most interesting in it. Let's take a listen.
Oh, my. Yeah. Okay.
Ew. Y'all need to open this door, man, for a huff and puff. Come on now, by the hands of your chinny chin chin.
Omar, you best roll out. We up in here with the Mac tank.
Oh, I think's not, Terrell. I think's not. Y'all might need to think this through and stop wasting my time. Because Omar can come back tomorrow. And the next day. And the next day. And I will put a bullet in all y'all behind what happened right now. You heard?
Oh, shit. Or should I say, shit. Omar's coming. The much-missed, much-loved Michael Kenneth Williams there as Omar Little from The Wire, of course. What a character. What a choice.
I love Omar. I mean, we all love Omar. And like Tony Soprano, who's a bit of a sort of a guilty pleasure, you kind of think, how can I love somebody who's a killer? But he's also, in my opinion, so he's not that dissimilar to Beth. He's so cool. He's so calm and collected. What is going on underneath that he's had to be so cool and calm in the face of almost daily threats of being killed, really, with the lifestyle he lives. And also the other thing that I think is interesting is that we can't separate him from the context in which he lives.
Yeah.
In a way, how else could he be?
Barack Obama said that The Wire is his favorite TV show of all time, and specifically cited Omar as his favorite character. And apparently, Omar was partially based on a real person, a former Baltimore drug dealer stick-up kid named Donnie Andrews, which is pretty crazy.
That is interesting. What the creator and writer David Simon said was his main inspiration was that it was actually a really old source. He said In our heads, we were writing a Greek tragedy, but instead of the gods being petulant and jealous Olympians hurling lightning bolts down at our protagonists, it's the postmodern institutions that are the gods. Ooh, I love that.
That's great. So what series are you watching? Because this is obviously is a bit of a departure for us. We tend to do series one, protagonist.
Like I said, it's an ensemble cast. So Omar is one of many protagonists. So we don't get to know that much about him in the same way that we have so far.
Right.
Which means that we're going to look at the first two series because Omar's story doesn't really get going properly until series one, episode six. So we'll be looking at the first two series.
Great.
And no one needs to worry if they can't remember because we'll do lots of recaps. Or you can go to justwatch.com and then you can see where you can stream or buy the episodes.
Yeah, or like me, dig out your old DVDs. I've got them all on DVD somewhere. I have to find them. And while I do that, I might dig out my old pager from the 90s, start hanging out with people who make toy furniture in readiness. All right, I'll see you next week, Sash.
Bye. Ta-da.
Now, in case you want to go back and study the game, here's our list of clip credits from The Queen's Gambit, created and written by Scott Frank and Alan Scott. Directed by Scott Frank, based on the novel by Walter Tevis. The opening clip, where Beth Harmon, Anya Taylor-Joy, intends to beat Benny Watts, Thomas Brody Sangster, that's episode 5, Fork. When Beth is interviewed by the Life magazine journalist, played by Samantha Sewell, that's episode 3, Double Pawn. Jolene, played by Moses Boyd, telling Beth how it is in the orphanage, is from episode 1, Openings. And finally, Beth turning up to her first real tournament is from episode 2, Exchanges. The Queen's Gambit is produced by Flitcraft, Wonderful Films and Netflix. You can find all episodes to stream right there on Netflix. Thank you for listening and see you next week.